Blog Talk Radio.
Let's go. Yeah. Ghetto children singing. See, they eager to learn how to become the next world leaders. Brave hearts. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Book one, strategy, tactics, techniques. Look dumb, but massively notice the weakness in all them. Gotta use it only if necessary. Homie, vestige is very real if enemies carrying heavy steel. Beware the thugs who ain't scared of blood or jail time. When Aryan nations ain't having integration, we so blind the beauty of life. Was when my mom said, again, you could be Christ. I wasn't old enough to hold my D&P right. Jesus, what is he like? I picture him standing with diamonds on him, little different from the way my mommy saw him. Practice your aiming, physical training and difficult terraining. Test your endurance, try to keep your stamina banging, splitting duchess up, strap up. The armies of school, teaching smart ways to go. I'm thinking Gandhi was a fool, the chronic's a fool. Got me thinking out loud. Sleep on my drunkenness, I blow your brains out. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here.
My revolution is as real as Bobby Seals. I build with dudes and Chris worth a quarter mil and Dick's Hill. For fish gills, a cop, none. The time come, I mask up and get my comrade off the bus. Up the beef, I snatch a seed from Chuck E. Cheese and feed them to the rats in the back of the peas. Black fatigue and off the scenes on a sofa. 50-inch flat screen, Louis Vuitton holster. My motions don't appeal to appellate division. I did it strong for 7 long years in prison. Up the system, I'm like a modern-day Hitler. Black gorilla, crib and blood in one only. Just know my face, I be the cage for the wish at the police. Look at the name Lake, go simultaneously with street revolution. 21 gun salute, the new Huey
Newton. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Teach our woman how to hold a family down in case something happens to us fathers. Protect the children, grab revolvers. The woman plays an important part of our life force of what we fight for. My heart goes to you, beautiful wife in war.
Enlist in more and talk less. Watch all and trust none. Demand your respect and be ready to die for what you believe in. And
hello?
Ride all the time, not just when convenient.
Justice and freedom, wisdom and understanding. We the lost children of Israel in this Western world region. You ain't a man, you a coward if you can't support the girl you put a seed in.
Strong rule the weak, but the wise rule is strong. It's more to a war than just getting it on. Seal your form, cover your tracks, stay prepared. I don't care, no one's spared.
Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here.
I'm a soldier for life. The battle I'm fighting has no ending. To struggle is to go the distance. To win is not to care how far one must go.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How do we get access to this, Jackson?
His lawyers say they can get me in posing as a legal investigator.
You were Huey Newton's lawyer, right?
Yes.
And now, Mr. Jackson.
Mitch Jackson was sentenced 1 year to life for a $70 gas station robbery.
We have 2 hours.
Waiting a long time.
We need brothers who can maintain their self-respect in here, have true strength.
Some people are comparing you to Eldridge Cleaver, Richard Wright, Du Bois. How does your fame affect you when you're locked up all day?
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Do you understand that there cannot be a peaceful revolution?
Okay, gentlemen, we're taking over!
Mr. Jackson, I'm sorry about your brother.
They will live to regret it.
from TV CSI.
This is the military, David.
Revolutionary greeter, free to land. This is your host, Conrad Bumani Secure. Welcome to another edition of Georgia University Radio, where our goals are fivefold. Our first goal is to eradicate constraint literacy among new African black prisoners. Two, to eradicate cultural ignorance among new African prisoners. Three, to transform the criminal mentality to the new African mentality. Four, to assist in the rebuilding and stabilization of the new African community. Five, to prepare new African prisoners for release, reducing new African recidivism. But before I bring in a guest tonight, I'd like to share a couple of events that happened during this week during history. Okay, on March 9th, 1931, Walter F. White was named the NAACP Executive Secretary. March 9, 1966, Andre F. Brown became the first black governor of the Federal Reserve Board. Also, March 9, 1896, Plessy v. Ferguson, a Supreme Court decision, legalizing separate but equal public facility for blacks and whites. Also, on March 9, 1980, Jill Scott Heron, the daughter of Jill Scott Heron, was born in 1980. Also on March 9th, the born day of Kenneth Kwame Welch, a long time activist and freedom fighter, new African independent movement, born in 1962. Also on March 9th, you had a born day of Kuba Jitu, advocate of the principles of George Jackson and the spirit of resistance. And fighting resistance spirit of George Jackson. Also on March 9th, on March 10th, 1863, two infantry regiments, 1st and 2nd South Carolina Volunteers, captured and occupied Jacksonville, Florida, causing panic along southern seaboard. On March 10th, 1913, Harriet Tubman, who was an abolitionist, Underground Railroad conductor, known as Moses, and a Union Army spy and commander, died in Auburn, New York at age 92. In 1969, March 10th, James Earl Ray pleaded guilty in a Memphis court to charges of killing Martin Luther King Jr. He was sentenced to 99 years in prison. The House Select Committee on Assassination said later that Ray fired the shot that killed King, but that he was probably one element in a larger conspiracy. Also on March 10, 1976, George Jackson Brigade member John Sherman was liberated. Okay, on March 11, 1874, Frederick Douglass was named the president of the Failing Freedmen's Bank. Also on March 11, 1887, Charles A.J. Taylor of Kansas named Minister to Liberia. He resigned November 11, 1887. Also on March 11, 1956, a manifesto denounced the Supreme Court ruling on segregation in public schools issued by 100 Southern senators and representatives. Also, March 11, 2016, former Black Panther Mondo Waylango died after 44 years in prison. On March 12, 1864, two New Orleans Black leaders, engineer Jean Baptiste Rodriguez and wine merchant Arnold Bermentor carried a petition to the White House, asked for equal rights and balance. Lincoln rejected the petition, saying that he did nothing in matters of this kind upon moral grounds, but solely upon political necessities. Also, on March 12, 1964, Malcolm X resigned for the Nation of Islam. Also, on March 12, 1972, where it occurred March 10th and March 12th, 3,000 delegates and 5,000 observers attended the first National Black Political Convention in Gary, Indiana. The NAACP and other groups withdrew from the convention after the adoption of a resolution critical of busing and the state of Israel. The group also adopted resolutions calling for a guaranteed annual income and a massive economic development plan for Black America. Also on March 12, 1976, George Jackson Brigade member Mark Cook was captured. On March 13, 1862, Congress changed the military code and forbade Union officers and troops to aid in the capture and return of fugitive slaves in what one historian called the military slave hunt. Also, March 13, 1865, Jefferson Davis signed a bill authorizing use of slaves as soldiers in the Confederate Army. And the slaves still were going on at that time. It was officially adopted to December 1865. Also, March 13, 1869, Arkansas legislature passed an anti-Klan bill. Also, March 13, 1970, the Senate extended the Voting Rights Act of 1965 to 1975. Also, March 13, 1984, Republican James L. Ussery elected first black mayor of Atlantic City, New Jersey. Also, on March 3, 1979, Madison and Granada overthrew Eric Gehry and established the People's Revolutionary Government. On March 14, 1794, Eli Whitney patented cotton gin that made cotton king and increased demand for slave labor. Also, on March 14, 1973, North Carolina prison union reform. Okay, I want to thank everybody. I want to thank all the listeners who've been calling to our show, who've been actually involved in our radio broadcast in 2014. I want to thank all the people, the youth, especially the youth, for educating themselves, continuing to push liberation and the struggle. I want to say a shout out to all the political prisoners and prisoners of war who still continue to get fight and continue to educate the brothers and sisters on the land as well as in the sea. And I'd like to bring on to the show tonight Dr. Johanna Fernandez. How you doing, good sister?
I'm good. Thank you so very much for having me on your show.
Yes. Thank you for doing your work. Before we start, can you tell the people about a little bit about yourself before we start and get into your broadcast?
Yes. You want me to tell folks about me?
Yeah. Tell the folks a little bit about yourself.
Yes, absolutely. So I am a professor of history at Baruch College of the City University of New York. And I've been working on a book on the Young Lords for a very, very long time. And it is now out, and I'm proud and happy to be able to share everything I learned with your listening audience and with the world. And I'm also very involved in the campaign to bring Mumia home. I'm part of the larger movement of Free Mumia Abu-Jamal, the imprisoned radio journalist, former Black Panther, who was wrongly accused of killing a white police officer in Philadelphia in 1981. I'm a revolutionary, and we need to figure out how we're going to do this.
True indeed. I got a lot of questions for you, because you're involved in a lot of different things.
I'm also one more thing. I'm also the host,
okay. And
this is a new hat that I'm wearing. I'm also the host of a morning show on WBAI, which is a historic community controlled non-corporate radio station in New York City at 99.5 FM, or at WBAI.org. I do the morning show from 7 to 8 a.m. And I've never done radio, but I was asked to do this during a very difficult moment in the history of the station. It was shut down by its parent organization, Pacifica. And we literally litigated it back again. And so when it reopened, I was asked to help out the station by taking on the morning show, which is an enormous amount of work. It's Monday through Thursday from 7 to 8 a.m. And I'm doing it, and it's been an exhilarating experience, an enormous amount of work, but exhilarating, because it's an opportunity to influence consciousness and an attempt, a revolutionary analysis and reporting on what's going on in the world.
True indeed. The influence of media is extremely important in regards to educating our people and the masses, especially in regards to issues involving mass incarceration, political prison, and so forth and so on, right? That's a very good thing that you're doing.
And your work is that important, the work that we're both doing, because 70% of media is owned by corporations and people need to hear what's going on in the world and assessments and analysis from Gowers. So congratulations and all power to you as you continue this important work, which you've been doing for some time.
True indeed. All power to yourself. True indeed. You know, I appreciate it. I appreciate what you're doing. You know, the way I look at it, like you said just recently, that we don't control the media. So every opportunity we get, it's on us to control and manipulate the narrative, so we can show the masses exactly what we're doing in regard to our struggles, exactly what we're doing in regard to the oppression, the poverty, the miseducation, the mass incarceration, and all the other calamities that we face as people. You know, so it's on us to educate people, to liberate them, so they can liberate themselves, because we all liberate like that, like Bobby Jaleel Mutha King said. Like I said, I have a few questions for you. My first question is, I understand that you teach 20th century U.S. history and history of social movement, right? What exactly is the history of the social movement? What exactly is that? And what are you teaching in regards to that?
So I teach the history of the 60s, and that's a seminar. I teach a seminar on the 60s. All of the movements of that era, the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement. I teach on the Black Panthers, on the gay and lesbian liberation movement, the women's movement, the new left broadly defined, the anti-war movement. I teach the Vietnam War in that class from the perspective of the Vietnamese. I teach on the Cuban Missile Crisis, broad class on the 60s, and then I also teach a class titled From Civil Rights to Black Power, which focuses on the Black struggle from World War II to 1973.
Okay, very, very interesting. You know, that those appeal to time in regard to a lot of people again incarcerated, being in exile, a lot of people fighting resistance. Also a time where a lot of civil rights came into vote, like the Voting Rights Act and, you know, women's rights and other aspects what came into position during that particular time. But people still understand that the 13th Amendment still recognized modern-day slavery, which it appears as a mass incarceration. We still recognize that and is acknowledged, right? You know,
right. No.
Those are very good areas to teach about. In order to educate the people, you know. One question I have for you, I see that you do a lot of work for Mumia Abu-Jamal and the Move family. Can you tell me how did you get involved with the elder Mumia Abu-Jamal? How did you get involved with him?
So in the 1990s, as you probably know, there was a massive movement to save his life because he was facing execution. In fact, he faced during the 1990s. And that, coupled with the fact that he wrote a bestseller titled Live from Death Row, it was a New York Times bestseller, which told the story of imprisonment from the inside, but also from the perspective of someone who was on death row and soon to be executed. That led to an international movement in the hundreds of thousands that people are not very familiar with. So I was among the many people who marched in the streets of New York, of Washington, D.C., and in Philadelphia, because the case is from Philadelphia. I was among the many who participated in the movement to free Mumia. Mumia was a household name. And also for people who were coming of age politically, he was kind of the Che Guevara of our time. But then I landed in Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon, in 2004, I believe. And I was now a professor, and I was on a postdoctoral fellowship. And it's a long story. I'll try to make it short. Elaine Brown went to speak at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, where I was teaching. It's my new appointment. And it was the first week of the semester, or maybe the second, and I went to hear her speak. I was excited. And students who brought her there weren't very experienced, and they didn't have anything prepared like an introduction. And it's a hilarious story, and she's very funny. She said, "Well, kids, I'm not going to sing a song. I need a podium because I'm going to give a talk." So the students scrambled around. They got the podium, and then she said, "Well, I'm going to need a mic." And then she said, they got the mic, and then she said, "Well, someone's going to have to introduce me." And there was a long, long wait. They didn't have an introduction prepared. I finally raised my hand and introduced her. And that caught the attention of a professor emeritus, a retired professor, who then approached me afterwards and said, "You need to go visit Mumia Abu-Jamal, who's only an hour away from here, and we need to rebuild a movement here in Pittsburgh to free him." And I had removed myself from politics somewhat because I had a really terrible experience right before I left New York. So I said, "You mean Mumia Abu-Jamal, who's sitting up on death row? What am I going to add to that conversation?" This professor, David Demarest was his name, he died, kept on visiting me daily in my office. And finally, I threw the towel in, I wrote to Mumia, got on his list, and started visiting him and other men on death row, including Russell Maroon Schoetz, political prisoner Russell Maroon Schoetz at SCI Green in Pennsylvania. And that was a transformative experience. You get a sense that even people on death row, especially people on death row, are human beings. And our society throws people away, throws Black people away. And this was Lynch Row. And so I, at that point, committed myself to continuing the struggle against mass incarceration, but also I committed myself to the struggle to free political prisoners, and Mumia Abu-Jamal in particular. I don't know what to tell you. Mumia has written like 11 books from prison. He's known as the voice of the voiceless. He is a revolutionary who talks about all of the problems in the world and never about him. And he was a radio journalist before he was incarcerated at the age of 28. And he's got profound insight. So I was enriched by those visits. And I think that visiting men on death row just humanized me in ways that I never imagined I would be. And I'm still doing this work.
Sure indeed. Yes, the brother's a very brilliant brother. And like you said, the brother, the voiceless, and he been continuing to push. He started out in the struggle as a young individual, as a teenager, in regards
exactly.
to pushing the liberation of our people. And it's very, very important. I also see that you edited one of his books, The Writing on the Wall. You edited one of his books, which is a great book, a good thing that you did. And also, can you tell a little bit more about the article that you wrote called The Roots of Mass Incarceration with Mumia Abu-Jamal? Can you tell a little bit more about this article and what inspired
it? Right. So this was a special volume of the journal Socialism and Democracy, which I co-edited with Mumia Abu-Jamal, and we co-wrote the introduction. It's a volume on the repression of Black radicals in the 1960s and the imprisonment of black radicals and the ways in which that targeting of black radicals in the 60s was then deployed against the entire black American community in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. So it's called locking up black dissidents, punishing the poor, the roots of mass incarceration. So it essentially identifies the roots of mass incarceration with the repression of people who were fighting against racism and for liberation in the 1960s, that the demonization of that small group of people and the expansion of the prison system in that period was a stepping stone to the mass incarceration of people living in the cities, mostly people of color, black Americans and Latinos, at a moment when deindustrialization was hitting the cities in a big way in the 1970s and 80s. And incarceration became a way to suppress the majority of these communities that could no longer be employed by the urban economy. So it makes a series of arguments about how crime and crime talk and law and order also became a way to deflect attention from the mass robbery by corporations of workers' wages in the 1980s and 90s. Essentially, mass incarceration also became its own jobs program for deindustrialized rural areas across the country, where people who had been who had lost their jobs to deindustrialization, mostly white communities, then became part of the prison industrial complex that employed them, like guards and the many other workers that work in the criminal justice system. One of the things we identify, which is your listening audience is aware of, is that the criminal justice system is the third largest employer in the United States. So after the civil rights and black power movement, imprisonment and the imprisonment of black people became the biggest employer in the U.S., one of the biggest employers in the U.S. So these are some of the issues that we treat. And we, of course, highlight the political prisoners that are being held by the state, former Black Panthers and activists of the 1960s and 70s.
True indeed. True indeed. Can you tell a little bit about your museum exhibit that will be around a Young Lord legacy? Can you tell a little about the museum exhibit?
So I wrote a book about the Young Lords, the Puerto Rican counterpart of the Black Panther Party, and that's called The Young Lords, A Radical History. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press. But before, in the run-up to finishing the book, I co-curated a series of exhibits here in New York City in 2015. The exhibits were shown in three different sites in the Bronx and two in Manhattan. And it's essentially an exhibition of different facets of the organization. So in the Bronx, we featured the organizing of the Young Lords in a hospital that they occupied, Lincoln Hospital in the Bronx, which they occupied in order to dramatize conditions of health under which Black Americans and Puerto Ricans were being treated. At the moment, at that time, the Bronx had the largest heroin addiction numbers in the country, if not the world. And essentially, the people in the community, the Bronx, the South Bronx, were afflicted with what the Young Lords and the Black Panthers called diseases of poverty, diseases that could be resolved if people didn't live in poverty, like high blood pressure and diabetes and a high mortality rate among children and babies. So we focused in the Bronx on the occupation by the Young Lords of that hospital and how they organized patients and workers and doctors to deliver health care with dignity at a moment when there was an enormous amount of discrimination, medical discrimination against Puerto Ricans and Black Americans. We also featured the work of the Young Lords around the question of women's equality within the organization. So the Young Lords members who were women launched a struggle internally to challenge the male leadership and the men of the organization on the question of male chauvinism. And that was a pretty fierce fight that got a woman elected to the leadership body of the organization, Denise Oliver, who, by the way, is not Puerto Rican, but Black American. One of the fascinating things about the Young Lords is that approximately 30% of its membership was Black American. Another small percentage of the organization was composed not of Puerto Ricans, but of other Latinos from the Dominican Republic, Colombia, Panama. And so the Young Lords is one of the most ethnically diverse organizations of people of color of that period of the 1960s. There was an exhibit at the Museo del Barrio on Fifth Avenue, which is a museum that emerged in part because of the activism of the Young Lords and others in the 1960s to feature the art of Latinos in the U.S. Museum, we featured the garbage offensive. The Young Lords asked the community, you know, what do you think is the biggest problem? And people said the garbage. New York was a disaster on wheels with the garbage. And they organized a series of garbage burning protests in which the community was involved. The sanitation department didn't pick up the garbage that they had neatly gathered over many weeks. And they decided to put that garbage that was not picked up in the middle of the street. They blocked traffic for blocks. And the community participated in burning the garbage. The fire department and the police department got involved. This seemed like a riot. This made the news over many, many weeks. The question of the garbage, because of the militancy and activism of the Young Lords in East Harlem, over the summer months, consistently, daily, these kind of garbage rebellions finally made it to the mayoral debate in 1969 and forced the mayor to systematically address the lack of sanitary services in Harlem and East Harlem. And the Young Lords held press conferences and essentially said that this is environmental racism, that the city is intent on treating Black and Puerto Rican people like garbage, but we will resist. And they won. And so the exhibition in East Harlem at the Museo del Barrio featured that garbage protest. And so on and so forth. So the exhibitions feature the different campaigns that the young lords were involved in, one of which was a campaign against lead poisoning among children. They worked with technicians and people in the community, but also with doctors, and they went door to door to test children for lead poisoning and found that a third of the children they tested were lead positive. And as you know, lead poisoning is a neurotoxin that produces permanent brain damage. And they were very good at influencing the media and essentially controlling the narrative of the analysis of the problem. And exposing the city. So they held a series of press conferences. They occupied the office of the Department of Health and forced the city to pass for the first time anti-lead poisoning legislation and to form the Bureau of Lead Poisoning. So, the Young Lords were a very fascinating, very successful revolutionary group that they were anchored in the community. They were influenced hugely by the Black Panther Party. And what distinguished them from other organizations, and I think the Black Panthers were successful at this, is that they were both organizers and they were organizing at the level of the community and trying to build the broader movement of the 60s, but they also built a revolutionary party and they were self-proclaimed socialists. And they were proponents of the independence of Puerto Rico. So they were revolutionary nationalists who stood for the independence of Puerto Rico. And they made common cause in New York City with the Black Panthers, although the Black Panthers faced homicidal violence on the part of the police and went underground for a minute, but the Young Lords continued that work, although they too faced repression at the hands of the counterintelligence program of the FBI.
Sure, indeed. I heard you mention the Lincoln Detox, right? And I'm familiar with that particular history in regards to Citizen Republic, Africa, and Black Panther. They've been actually involved in and then basically that takeover to bring people to understand to our people. My question to you is, can you tell me the relation between the Puerto Rican movements and the Black Liberation Movement, the New African Independent Movement behind enemy lines in prison as well as on the streets? Can you tell me the relation between that and why it's important to understand the relation?
So in the 1960s, you mean in the 1960s? The relationship between the Black Freedom Movement and the Puerto Rican Movement?
Yes, yes, yes. Well, it's in the 70s too, you know.
And in the 70s. So essentially, the Young Lords emerged in Chicago as a gang that was politicized by its leader, Chacha Jimenez. And Chacha Jimenez was imprisoned over many years. He experienced recidivism, but he was politicized in prison. And when he left prison in 1968, he determined to politicize the Young Lords. And eventually he met up with the chairman of the Chicago chapter of the Black Panther Party, Fred Hampton. And Fred Hampton participated in that politicization of the gang. And in fact, it was Fred Hampton who launched the Rainbow Coalition, the first Rainbow Coalition, which was a coalition of Puerto Rican, Mexican, in the Young Lords, the Black Panthers, and the Young, who were a group of poor whites from Appalachia. And in his mind, the mind of the leader of the Black Panthers in Chicago, this was an important coalition of working class people across racial and ethnic lines. So from the beginning, the young lords were seeing common cause with not just the black movement, but the most criminalized, the baddest, the most demeaned group in the country, the Black Panthers, that had been identified by the FBI as the major national security threat. Mind you, the Black Panthers are, if they're guilty of anything, they're guilty of essentially saying that kids need to go to school with a full and so the Black Panthers were the first activists and radicals to think that serving breakfast to poor children was critical to their learning. And so even though the Black Panthers are not often credited, they are responsible for today's school lunch program and school breakfast program. So the Black Panthers are important for that, and the Young Lords created these programs that mirrored those initiated by the Black Panthers. And then the Black Panthers, as you know, are known because they initiated the first Cops Watch projects in Oakland. That's how they started out. They started out policing the police, and they did it within the law. And because they were so successful at policing the police, they became the target of the police. So the Young Lords essentially worked closely with the Black Panther Party in Chicago, but also in New York. You should know that before the Young Lords occupied Lincoln Hospital, many of the members of the Panther 21, the 21 Black Panthers from New York, who were targeted by the police and falsely accused of bombing, attempted bombings of the Board of Education and a police precinct in New York. So the Panther 21, before they were incarcerated, they had occupied a mental health clinic at Lincoln Hospital, which is why they became the targets of the police. And they were successful. They essentially took over the mental health clinic or helped take over the mental health clinic, in part because there was a shift from mental health as therapy in the Bronx at this mental health clinic to the mental health strategy relying on medication, among many other things. That's one of the reasons why they took over the mental health clinic. But they also believed that the mental health clinic needed to be run by people in the community, and that the community needed to have a say on how the institutions controlling their lives or influencing their lives should look like. In any case, it was immediately after the occupation of that mental health clinic that the Panther 21 were entrapped, essentially incarcerated, demonized, criminalized wrongfully for terrorist actions that they were not involved in. And in fact, that case of the Panther 21 in New York City was the longest case in New York City history, and they were exonerated. They were freed. But that took a hit on the organization, and the Young Lords continued to work with what was left of the Black Panther Party, and they continued the activism at Lincoln Hospital. In New York City, Black and Puerto Rican people lived in the same neighborhoods in East Harlem and in Harlem. So they were living in the same housing projects. They were, both groups were the victims of deindustrialization, which in New York City started immediately after World War II. They were both victims of police brutality. They danced in the same dance halls, and there was conflict between the groups, but the Young Lords and the Black Panthers attempted to build unity among these oppressed groups. That's what I can tell you. And of course, the Puerto Rican revolutionaries, quite a number of them, including the Young Lords, but others who were incarcerated for their activities in relationship to the freedom of Puerto Rico, those Puerto Ricans who became political prisoners essentially thought of themselves as one and the same with Black Panthers and Black Liberation Army activists who had also been imprisoned during that time. And you should know also that Mutulu Shakur, who's now a political prisoner, worked with the Young Lords at Lincoln Hospital in a detox clinic that the Young Lords and Mutulu Shakur and some Black Panthers helped run, and they founded that used it used Eastern techniques to address the issue of substance abuse. So it used acupuncture. It was one of the first detox clinics to use acupuncture to address drug addiction successfully. There was common cause. There was a sense in this period, common cause between Puerto Ricans and African Americans. There was a sense that both communities were oppressed, that they needed to come together to fight their oppressors from a position of strength. There was a sense that that essentially the United States had a colony in Puerto Rico, right? Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States, became a colony in 1898, that Puerto Ricans were a colonized people, but that here in the U.S. mainland, in cities like New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, so in the South, the U.S. government was creating colonies in Black communities and in Puerto Rican communities and in Mexican communities and in Native American communities, and that we are all colonized people who have to come together and fight against our common oppressor.
Indeed. You know, that's a very important history, especially in regards to the Attic Rebellion, where you had various people from the Young Lords and other organizations that were adamant in the struggle. And also now we see that in New York, you had Alma Lancoing Charter Nation that had taken a lot, that had been open to a lot of politics in regards to liberating the oppression of the Five Islands, so to speak, of Latino people, Puerto Rico, Dominican, et cetera. You know, they've been adamant in that aspect, right? And also, as I look at it, it was a lot of people that were prominent in the prison movement in New York, like Martin Gonzalez Soltry, which was basically the one individual that started fighting for prisoners. He was fighting for prisoner rights, and especially in regard to the voice of prisoners. You know, and a lot of the interns And whether it's the assassinated Comrade George pushed forth the Attic Rebellion, because Martin Sosgar already put it out there, like in the late 60s, that they were getting the inhumane rights in regards to human rights. So he pushed that aspect out there. So I want to ask you about the files that you obtained through the legal process. What is the significance of these files that you obtained called the Hansu file? What is the significance of those files? And how they pertain to the movement that you're talking about right now, in particular to the 60s and the 70s and the 50s?
Yes. What is
the significance of them?
Before I talk about that, I want to talk a little more about this issue that you raise surrounding prisoner resistance and rebellion. So in the summer of 1970, there were prisoner uprisings in New York City at the Tombs, which was infamous for its conditions. The conditions at the Tombs literally drove prisoners insane. There was an enormous amount of violence at the hands of guards, and that summer there was a rebellion and upheaval, and it spread across all of the prisons, of the jails. The Tombs was a jail, all where people were held because they couldn't post bail, and they were held there indefinitely before their trial for a year, sometimes 2 years. And so part of what the Black Panthers and the Young Lords did was to amplify in their activism and in their newspapers the humanity and the grievances of prisoners who were rebelling. And then this was in the summer of 1970. And in many ways, this is a struggle that's forgotten, but it was this struggle in New York City jails that inspired the Attica Rebellion in the state a year later. So a young lord was arrested on false charges by the police, and he was found hanged in the Tombs. It was concluded that in any case, the causes of his death are almost immaterial. The man should never have been arrested, and he was pretty much lynched and killed by the prison system. The Young Lords, in response, took over a church that they had taken over once, but this time they took over the church and protest with guns. And a negotiation with the city officials and the mayor ensued, and the Young Lords turned the church into an abolitionist center, a center that essentially upheld the rights and the humanity of prisoners, and they held legal clinics and opened up the church to people who were exiting the prisons. They amplified the situation that was growing and that no one knew was going to grow into this monster we know as mass incarceration. So they amplified the issues of imprisonment and the horrific conditions that of the prisons and prisoners, and the fact that essentially the government was targeting people of color and putting them in cages. And their occupation led to the first ever investigation of the death of a citizen in a prison, in a jail in New York City, and it was ordered by the mayor of New York City. So in many ways, the activism of the Young Lords and the Black Panthers in the late 1960s and early 70s were a prelude of the activism that we see today against mass incarceration and against police violence. Did I lose you?
No, I'm listening to you. So I said they were interesting. I'm just listening to what you were saying. I said they were interesting, right? Those were interesting.
So you asked me about the Handschuh files. So this is a long story, but it's an important one. So in 2014, I sued the NYPD for its failure to release to me the surveillance records of the Young Lords, the organization I was studying and researching for my book. Under the Freedom of Information Law, all records requested formally by any citizen should be released by the cops or any institution. So I had been requesting these records because I knew they existed for 10 years. And one day I decided, why don't I just go inside? I'm from New York. I'm from the Bronx. So why don't I just go to One Police Plaza, which is the headquarters of the police, and say, yo, what gives? Like, we've been in this conversation over the mail, but what are you going to do? Are you going to release the files that are due any citizen and to me as a professor engaged in research for a book? These papers should have been released. They're due to me by law. In any case, they said, yes, we know your request, and we're about to make a decision, and you're going to be happy about it. They were very respectful, and they called me Professor Fernandez. And then 6 months later, they sent me a letter telling me that they were going to dismiss the case on a technicality. So I got pissed off, essentially. I borrowed money, and I sued them. And it turns out that I was the first person to sue them for their failure to release records that were ordered, preserved at the Municipal Archive of the City of New York by a judge in 1985. And that court order that these records of surveillance had to be preserved were part of the decision in the important Handschuh case. The Handschuh case was filed in 1971 against the NYPD, and it accused and claimed and sued the NYPD for violating the rights of New Yorkers on the basis of their association, political association. So let's backtrack. I mentioned the Panther 21. During the Panther 21 case, it was discovered that undercover police officers in the Black Panther Party were trying to entrap Black Panthers and get them to say that they wanted to bomb this, that, and the third. And that's why the Panther 21 were released, because it was proven in court that in fact it was the cops who were the gangsters as undercover cops who wanted to turn the organization into something that it was not. All of these files emerged during the Black Panther case, because they were subpoenaed by the judge. So after the end of the Panther 21 case, a number of lawyers decided to sue the NYPD for its violation of First Amendment rights, in particular the right to association, political association, without persecution by the government. So this is known as the Han Shu case, which won. And after the end of the case in 1985, essentially the judge ordered that all of these files be preserved, all of these files of surveillance, over a million files of surveillance of the NYPD, surveillance by the NYPD of American citizens, of New Yorkers, essentially, and political organizations, but also everybody and their mother was surveilled, regardless of whether you were politically involved or not. This is at the height of the Cold War. So the judge said, okay, you need to preserve these records because New Yorkers need to know what the cops have done so that their rights won't be violated in the future. That's what the judge said. So you guys, the NYPD, you need to take all of these records and deposit them at the Municipal Archive of the City of New York, which is the major public records library in New York City. And he established what are known as the Han Shu rules, which established that cops cannot surveil citizens or organizations in New York City without first getting permission from a judge and showing cause for why this citizen or this organization is going to be surveilled. But of course, those laws were pretty much whittled down immediately after 9/11. In any case, what's important for your listening audience to know is that it was the repression of the Black Panthers in New York, and the fact that emerged in the case involving the repression of Black Panthers in New York City, the Panther 21 case, which led to the suit against the NYPD that expanded our understanding of American freedom. Prior to this moment, the First Amendment had been litigated only around the issue of freedom of speech. But as you know, the First Amendment has two things in it. It says all Americans have the right to freedom of speech and association, political association. And so part of what happened in the Han Shu case is that political association was added and expanded in the court as something that had to be protected by the law, or couldn't be violated by the police. And of course, we know that the police violate whatever the hell they want, but this is pretty significant. In any case, I sued the NYPD. We were in court for the files because the files included the files of the Black Panthers, but also of the Young Lords and everyone else that was active during this period. So I was in court for 2 years. At the end of 2 years, the judge dismissed the case. She was very friendly to me and she wanted us to win, but she said, I don't know what else to do. The cops have told me that they looked everywhere for these files. They can't find them. I've asked them to photograph all the places where they have looked, and they've brought me sworn statements and the photographs where they say they've looked. Unclear what I should do. So we left the courtroom after 2 years. The cops were horrific every time we met. And my lawyer turns to me and says, well, I'm sorry, Professor Fernandez, we tried. And I was like, what? We tried? No, we got to continue the struggle and we need to appeal this bad boy. And so we decided to go to the media. We went to New York One, which is like the CNN of local news here in New York City, that local politicians and people in city government watch. It's, you know, the news about everything that's going on in New York, everything under the sun. In any case, we go to New York One. I get interviewed by one of its top reporters, and the reporter turns to me and says, you know what? the cops are having a press conference right now, and I'm going to go talk, ask a question about these files. This reporter rolled up at the press conference of the cops, talked, cross-examined the commissioner of the NYPD, asked them about Professor Fernandez's files, and are you trying to hide these files that are so historically significant? And 2 weeks later, their lawyers called my lawyer, and clearly someone made a call and said, okay, it's time to release these files because it's the Black Lives Matter moment, and this is the last thing that we need on our backs. So they released over a million records, including those of the surveillance of Malcolm X, which is what I was looking for. I mean, the Hanshu files. Yeah, so that's the story. And this is all over the New York Times, by the way. Like, I was, when I first filed the suit, I was immediately called by the New York Times because I didn't know that I was the first person to sue them for not releasing files that a judge posited with the Municipal Archive of the City of New York. So I got a call from the New York Times. They interviewed me. And then when they were found finally 2 years later, they interviewed me again. So folks can, who want to look this up, can just type my name, Johanna Fernandez, and Hanshu is spelled H-A-N as in Nancy, D, S as in Sam, C as in cat, H-U. The Hanshu case. Very, very important case for radicals, for activists, for people who fight for social justice. I would love to continue to talk to you, but I in fact have an emergency conference call of the Movement to Free Mumia at 9 that I'm now 7 minutes late to.
Oh, okay. Can you give us a final thought before you leave? And I appreciate you coming to your pocket. You know what I'm saying? I said, can you give us a final thought before you leave? A way to answer your book and things. And did you get a little final comment before you leave?
Yes, absolutely. Well, I can text you a 40% off code for those who want to purchase my book. I wrote this book for a new generation of activists and freedom fighters and revolutionaries. It is a thriller of a book, which will give you the inside scoop on the Young Lords and their campaigns, but will also give you a sense of the politics and where they came from of that period for the Young Lords and the Black Panthers. Like, what did these organizations believe in, and why did they believe in the things they believed in? Who were their influences from the Cuban Revolution to the writings of Chairman Mao in China? My last thought is that we live in a world that is insane. It's been made insane by capitalism, and capitalism was made possible by the institution of slavery. And at some point we have to build a revolutionary movement that will put sane people at the helm of how to organize our society. And that's the sane people are us. We are the people that we've been waiting for. Ordinary people, working people at the bottom of society are a lot more humane than the monsters who are ruling over us. And is an attempt to lay out a little bit of the history, a long-standing history of struggle and courage and commitment by people at the bottom of society and people of color and oppressed people in the struggle for freedom.
True indeed. I want to thank you for carrying out the understanding. Thank you for the work that you have contributed in the past, as well as in the present, and the work I'm going to continue to do in the future. I don't wish you success. Please send any information to me through my text message about the book so I can spread it among others.
I'll text it to you right now.
Okay.
You have a wonderful one. And thank you so very much for your work.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, too, as well.
On a move.
To independence now. Tomorrow. The United States.
Yeah, they say those who do not move do not feel their chains, but the African people aware of their pain, aware of the game, invader deception, black presidents who are white man extensions, people from Cape to Cairo rebel, cause fake independence and ongoing hell, colonial ties still keep them chained, the richest continents getting robbed again, the IMF and World Bank criminal schemes, what about reparations? To me it seems that every metropole from Amsterdam to Paris and Brussels was built with the hands of African labor, a slave relation, developing Europe at expense of their nation, but Africans rebel from the first conquest till flag independence at last accomplished.
Il y en a qui demandent la lutte contre l'impérialisme. L'impérialisme, regardez dans vos affaires, quand vous mangez les grains de riz, de maïs, de mil importés, c'est ça l'impérialisme, n'allez pas plus loin.
Yeah. Ayo, the spirit of Lumumba lives on in Congo, like Thomas Sankara in Burkina Faso. Samora Michelle, it was Viva Frelimo, but Mozambique still fighting for freedom. Why did these three who dare to invent the future then clash to the fullest extent with the colonizers? If we open eyes, if we can see the rich whites, we're scared of rising African power, real independence, a people's politics, anti-capitalism. So they stifle their growth in every way, so that South Africa looks colonized today. For any flaws of Mugabe, that ain't what they hate. Zimbabwe's not a colony, make no mistake. Look at AFRICOM, the African command. That's the US and a puppet shaking each other's hands. Divide and conquer is a hell of a tactic. They blame Africa for relations that backward. The whole basis was plundered from outside Rwanda, Uganda. The Sudan's divides, pushing forward war for precious coltan. So cell phones and PCs are sold in lands where people don't know how they were constructed. Your Windows now functions from a child's destruction.